Saturday's election pits the incumbent, Mr. President, against political novice Ashley Richardson. The model agency owner thinks she has a good chance, but Mr. President did win the endorsement of the local media mogul. Last Sunday's debate focused on attracting new citizens, business accountability, and the big issue, crime. There are rumors that Mr. President hired a local gang to fix the primaries and that challenger Richardson left the debate early to go watch The Sopranos. And if none of this sounds familiar, it's because the election is in Alphaville, a virtual community in a game called The Sims Online. Mr. President and his challenger are both avatars, computer-generated characters who are the alter egos of a 21-year-old airline employee and a 14-year-old middle school student, respectively. Thousands of real people spend parts of their lives in Alphaville, and more than a million inhabit other so-called metaverses where they can don a suit of armor and battle dragons or command a spaceship and interact with other players from around the world. Later in the program, an update from the Enron prosecutions. We'll go to Houston, Texas, where a plea agreement with Lee Fasto, the wife of Enron finance chief Andrew Fasto, broke down today. But first, what can we learn from the politics and economics of virtual communities? Whether you control an avatar in one of these online metaverses, or if you're wondering about the attraction of these games and what people do in their alternate identities, our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. And joining us now from his home in Richmond, Virginia, is the president of Alphaville, Mr. President, or as he's known as Virginia, Arthur Baines. And good, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, how you doing, Mr. Conan?
Very well, Arthur. You feel confident about the Saturday's election?
Yeah, I feel pretty confident. I've got a lot of player support in the game, and from both sides, from the males and the females. You know, my work is spoken for itself. I've been the president for since last April, so I'm running for re-election this year.
So how did you get to be president in the first place?
Well, I'm actually part of the founding fathers of the Alphaville government, so to speak. Well, you know, we came up with the idea of doing the Alphaville government. We all got together, and we held our first election back in April, and I happened to come out on top on that one.
So why did you decide, as I understand it, when you all arrived in Alphaville a year ago or so, there was no government. Why did you decide that you need one?
Well, we needed something to protect the citizens, as we've coined Alphaville's, you know, citizens.
Mm-hmm.
We need something to protect them all, and you know, a lot of people have good ideas, but it's when the people with good ideas get together that, you know, things happen.
So, do the other founding fathers are they members of your cabinet, for example?
Well, I'd say one is a member of the cabinet now. The others are play a good part in the Alphaville government, and actually, two have departed from the game since then.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
So they've sort of moved elsewhere. You don't know where.
Well, they just they actually are not playing any longer.
They immigrated.
Yeah, you could say that.
Okay. Now, if the unfortunate should happen and you lose the election, you step down gracefully?
There's a 2-week transitional period that I set up to where if I did happen to come out on the bad end of the elections, that I give Ashley 2 weeks to settle in and then get in the swing of things. But I would step down gracefully, and it would prove that we do have a government that's run by the Sims at
By the Sims for the Sims?
Yeah, exactly. There you go.
Now, how much time do you devote to being president?
Well, as long as all the time that I'm on the Sims Online.
And how much time is that?
I'd say I try to get in a few hours a day.
You have a regular job.
Right, at Delta.
And this is, as I understand it, as looking at some of the stories about the campaign, this has been, you've described this as a drawback when you're running against a 14-year-old.
It could be looked at like that. We probably spend the same amount. I actually a lot of the other work is actually not logged on to the game. There's a lot of work that we do offline the game, keeping the website up with the do not trust list, or it's our wanted list. Alphaville. It's a list of sims that you need to watch out for.
Yeah, well, there's always those people, and as I understand, one big problem is something called scammers. What are those?
Well, they scam people out of their game currency. That it's called the simoleon. And for example, say you want to move to Alphaville, and you want to move out of Alphaville, so you give somebody your money. And you expect to get it back in the other city you move to. Well, there are people that say, "Hey, I'll take your money. I'll give it to you in that city. I run a nice bank here." They take your money, and then that's the last you ever see of them.
So these are con artists.
Basically, yeah.
Yeah. Well, if you also another question about the possibility of a loss in this election. If you lose, are you going to stay in Alphaville?
Well, Alphaville is the only city I've ever played in. All my friends are there. I'd definitely stay. I couldn't go by Mr. President anymore, but
you'd have to get a new avatar.
Well, you can actually change your name in there.
Well,
so I'd have to do that.
Might be Mr. Smith next time around. Thanks for joining us, and good luck Saturday.
Thank you.
Arthur Baines is a ticket agent for Delta Airlines, president of Alphaville in The Sims Online. He joined us from Richmond, Virginia. And with us now is Laura McKnight, an eighth grader from Jupiter, Florida, online. Ashley Richardson, the owner of Ashley's modeling agency. She's running against Mr. President for the top governmental seat. Good of you to join us today.
Hello?
Hi. Why are you running for president?
Well, I want to help Alphaville and basically just bring back fun in the game, because a lot of criminals and scammers are really just ruining it for a lot of the players.
And why should the people of Alphaville vote for you? You're unproven. They have somebody who's been in office a whole year.
Well, I think that Mr. President he goes on and he doesn't really answer his messages. He doesn't really take action in a lot of important things. Like, The Sims Online, it's a game. I mean, you can't really, like, he bases it a lot on real life. And, like, a lot of his tactics are just like the government today. And I just think I could do a lot and help out the citizens as much as possible.
Now, you run a modeling agency, Ashley's Modeling Agency in Alphaville, right?
I did until about a month ago when the campaign started.
Didn't have the time anymore.
No.
Yeah. Why did you, when you went online in the first place, how did you end up running a modeling agency?
Well, actually, I used to do modeling in real life for a little while, a lot of beauty pageants. And I just thought it was familiar for me. And I started actually a mechanical house for skills and stuff in a casino. And they didn't work out too well, so I was like, why don't I open up a modeling agency? And I did that instead.
Is the game, particularly, as you say, with all of these scammers and involved, is it still fun for you?
It can be a little stressful at times, but it's really fun because I have a lot of good friends on there that I've known for like a year already from my modeling and stuff like that. So it's really fun. And also you get to see how people interact, and you could get to build up businesses, make money. It's really fun.
And how many people, we asked the Mr. President the same question. How much time every day do you spend online as Ashley Richardson?
Well, I usually play when I get home from school for a couple hours, maybe a little bit later sometimes if I have time, because I have homework, a lot of homework, so it takes up a lot of my time.
It could be a problem. We're going to take a call. Our number, if you'd like to join us, by the way, is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can email us at totn@npr.org. And Laura, thank you very much for joining us today, and you can thank us for getting you out of school early today, as I understand it.
Thank you.
Laura McKnight is a 14-year-old student. Her online character, Ashley Richardson, is running for president of Alphaville. We spoke with her from her home in Jupiter, Florida. To see the Alphaville Alphaville government homepage and read the local newspaper, the Alphaville Herald. You can go to the Talk of the Nation webpage at npr.org. And joining us now from his office at MIT is Professor Henry Jenkins, director of the Comparative Media Studies Program, a leading researcher on video games. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Happy to be here.
What is it about these games that attracts people like Mr. Baines and Laura McKnight?
Well, I would suggest that there's no one thing that attracts people to games, but the idea of an alternative world, another social sphere that parallels our own, is intriguing to an awful lot of people for different reasons. On one end of the spectrum, you might have senior citizens who used to be very socially active, might travel a lot, and now are housebound and are searching for a way beyond the home to engage with other people. On the other end, you might have someone like Ashley, you were just speaking to, a school student, and they have relatively little voice, little control in the society of the school or in the home or in the physical community, but the fact that a 14-year-old could run for president in one of these game spaces is enormously empowering to young people.
Well, let's get some listeners involved. Janice is on the line with us from Cleveland, Ohio.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a 50-year-old female who suffers with post-traumatic stress disorder, and I've been playing Sims since December of 2002. And I have found the Sims game very relaxing to me, a way of, like the others have said, meeting people. My city is Dan's Grove, and I don't know where else I can go in this world that I can own a chateau, be thin, rich, and beautiful, and have as many friends as I do around the world, such as Israel and the Netherlands.
But you say you meet other people. Of course, you're just meeting their avatars.
Correct.
And,
right. And when I've gone through, and all of us, whether we be in real life young or older like myself, we all have real life issues that we have learned to trust our other avatar friends with, and they are very concerned, sometimes more beyond our own real families.
Now, what do you see, Janice, when you log on and you become your avatar? What do you actually see?
I see a person who is, when people come to visit my home, which I have a service home. There are different categories of homes. People come in, a lot of new Sims come in. I help teach them the game. I, like the other people, I am against the scammers, and I help new people learn the game so that they can get, I will give money if they are polite. I teach them how to play it the right way so that it's most enjoyable to them.
As Henry Jenkins, she sounds like the person you were describing in your answer.
No, and very much. I think, you know, there are two myths about the Internet that come together in thinking about these online worlds. One is the idea of the Internet is a place where no one knows you're a dog. That is, who you are physically, your interactions with people face-to-face don't necessarily color what you can become in a virtual environment. And the other is the Internet is a place where everyone knows your name, like the bar on Cheers.
Mm-hmm.
And the sense of having a community of people you connect with. For a lot of kids in school who feel shut off or isolated for any number of reasons, having the whole planet to scan to find people you have something in common with is really powerful, compared to feeling like you're locked into a face-to-face community that often doesn't feel like it provides many options. Now, you're asking about virtuality, whether this is a real conversation. Realize the three of us are currently involved in a virtual conversation. The technology is a telephone. We've gotten used to that. Your listeners are listening via radio. It feels like a real conversation, at least between the three of us who can talk back and forth, and it feels physically present or intimate to the people in the listening on the radio at the present time. This is just a different interface, a different technology, which allows people to talk together who aren't necessarily geographically in the same place.
And I guess we could also be pretending to be thin and beautiful and rich if we wanted to be. Janice, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And we're going to be back with more on virtual worlds after a short break and take more of your calls. 800-989-8255. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about online gaming communities known as metaverses and the people that play them. Our guest is Henry Jenkins, director of MIT's Comparative Media Studies program. Of course, you're invited to join us. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And Professor Jenkins, before the break, we were mostly talking about one particular game called Sims Online, indeed, pretty much one place in Sims Online. There are many, as I understand it, but there are also many different kinds of these metaverses. Tell us a little bit about them.
Well, I think the metaverse model ranges from sort of sword and sorcery worlds, which can be, if they were physical spaces, might be as large as, say, the country of England, with small villages and people going out and slaying dragons and battling warrior hordes from other villages. Could be Star Wars. There's Star Wars Galaxies is a representation of the world we know from George Lucas's film series. It could be a battlefield during World War One or World War Two, both of which are modeled right now. It could be America's Army, which is a military-produced, massively multiplayer online game where you are members of a military unit and you're battling terrorism or enemy armies and realistic renditions of some of the places where our GIs actually have to fight. Or it could be something like The Sims, which is a much more realistic world, a suburban environment, a social interaction environment, but one that is concrete. You know, it may have its own fantasy elements. We know that the world of The Sims now faces organized crime, and that's something that certainly surprised people when that world was created. They didn't think that the quiet, peaceful suburban world that we're describing in Alphaville would face online prostitution, organized crime, or the scam artist.
Whoa! Online prostitution?
That's one of the things that's created a lot of stir has been that people are selling cyber sex in some of these games for credits in the game space. And that's one. So Alphaville itself was in the middle of a censorship controversy in which the reporter who ran the local paper tried to report and raise questions about the fact that underage kids were playing this game and selling virtual sex. And he faced censorship and was shut down, at least initially, by Maxis, the company that runs Sims Online. And that's sparked a discussion in places like Salon and the New York Times about censorship within virtual environments.
Why in the world, let me ask a question that may be fundamental here, why would anybody go to a virtual brothel?
I think, you know, we're asking a question that our society has been dealing with for some time. I hate to get totally off on cyber sex because I think it's sort of been overhyped, but people get off on social exchange. There's an erotic charge to interacting with other people. Your mind is often the most erogenous zone in your body, as they say. Hmm. So it's not that unusual in digital world for such things to go on. It is unusual in a game space, and it poses unusual questions in a game space, which attempts to mirror our own world. But which people in a game space often want to be doing something fantastical. They want to participate in a fantasy, do something they wouldn't do in everyday life. Indeed, the nature of fantasy is you often imagine transgressions you would never act on in your real world. But as these worlds become more real, as they become more populated by more different people, then the line between fantasy and reality becomes harder to maintain. And there are ethical issues, I think, being debated about what kinds of social interaction can occur in these spaces, what the impact of those interactions are for the people involved in those interactions, and what degree communities can police themselves in what is essentially a commercial space. You know, Sims Online was set up in part with the premise that it was an experiment in community building and democracy. That's part of the rhetoric that came out of that company. But it is not ultimately a free society or a public society in the sense that a city park is a place that where you pull up a soapbox. It is more like a shopping mall, that is a commercial environment where the commercial owners of that environment can determine who speaks there and who doesn't. And more and more our civic life is moving to commercial environments which set limits on what ideas can be explored. And so I think free speech in game worlds is one of those political debates that people are involved in right now.
Let's get another listener on the line. This is Don, who's with us from Chandler, Arizona.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, too.
Uh-huh.
I just wanted to let you know that there are some nice positives. My wife and I actually have four children, and they're quite young, and so we don't actually get out to do very much. But by playing one of these online games, the one that we played is called The Dark Age of Camelot, it actually allowed us to have extra social interaction with our, we would work together our backs, back to back in one room on two computers, and it allowed us to have a nice social life and be able to interact with people all around the world and be able to do these things, where it would have been hard to get out to enjoy doing something together, you know, having the children that would, we would have to have babysitters or somebody like that to be able to do that.
And who did you choose to be in Camelot?
I was a heroic knight in armor, and my wife was a support unit where she would be able to heal people, so she was what was called a cleric.
And how did you, I assume this was some sort of quest involved here?
Yes, it was one of the, you know, it was a Camelot legend thing, and the very cool thing about this massively multiplayer game is that it actually enabled a large conflict to go on between the different realms in the universe. And so you would work hard to get yourself up to a sufficient level, and then you would go out and for the sake of the realm, you would go and battle the other people. And so we actually built up good camaraderie and good friends in the game that you would work together to achieve these common goals.
In the process, as you say, you work your way up. How do you earn credits?
Well, it becomes, it's what they call the leveling grind. Essentially, you would log into the game and you would start working, and as you do more and more in the game, whether it's killing monsters or advancing in one way or another, you get what are called experience points. And as these points add up, your character becomes more and more powerful, and it allows you to accomplish greater and greater tasks. And so the games are actually structured around having you enter this grind and trying to present you more and more content, so that you feel satisfied and you will continue to pay the subscription fee to continue to use the game.
And how much was that, just out of curiosity?
This one was about $12 a month for each account.
And there was probably a drop in front for the software, right?
Yeah, it was about $20 at the time that we started. And then they like to come out with expansion packs and everything to try to... Those are also additional fees to buy the pack, but your constant... fee enables you to continue to pay them, and they continue to add content over time. So you might have new quests and new abilities and things come into the game to try to keep it new. But one of the features that was really neat is that they also provided non-combat options, so that, like, my wife was a tailor and I was an armor crafter, and we would work together to be able to build things and make equipment that the other characters in our guild or our immediate group of friends would actually be able to use to benefit them.
Hmm. Are you still doing this?
Actually, we've taken a couple of months hiatus. I've started a new company with some friends, so we've taken a couple of weeks off, or at least a couple of months, but we're actively waiting for the World of Warcraft to come out by Blizzard Entertainment, and that's something that I think that I'm going to get into as well.
Okay, well, good luck, Don.
Hey, thanks a bunch.
Go slay those dragons.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And Henry Jenkins, thank you for your time today.
Sure, happy to be here.
Henry Jenkins, director of the Comparative Media Studies Program at the MIT, and he was with us from his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. While the concept of a presidential election being held in an online community might be strange to some people, try this one. The currency, goods, and services used in online games also have real-life value. In the first financial quarter of 2004, around $6 million flowed through eBay for virtual items to be used in online games. That's $6 million real American dollars. Edward Castronova is a professor of economics at California State University Fullerton. He tracks the economies of these online worlds and joins us from the studios of KKJZ in Long Beach, California. Good to have you back on Talk of the Nation.
Yeah, nice talking to you again, Neil.
Explain to us, Ted, how an item that does not exist develops a dollar value.
Well, I would dispute whether or not it exists, first of all. And I just would point the listeners to the virtuality of the value of the dollars in their pockets, right? They only have value because other people will accept them. So, you know, we in economics, we have what's called the subjective theory of value, kind of a postmodernist concept of where value comes from. The value of something doesn't really come from its use necessarily, but just from the price that a market will put on it. You go to eBay and you see that there's a bunch of suppliers and a bunch of demanders, and they put positive real dollar prices on these gold pieces and magic wands and so on, and that's because some people want them and they're hard to get.
So they've established a secondary markets for these things.
Absolutely. It's a currency exchange market, not unlike the market between the yen and the U.S. dollar. As a matter of fact, the game that Don was talking about, Camelot, is a game that I have spent some time in. Its exchange rate has regularly beat the Japanese yen for more than a year.
Really? That's pretty good. So these exchange rates go up and down?
They fluctuate. Some of them are more stable than others. The long-run trend is always for the value of the virtual world currency to go down as time goes by. The economies in there tend to inflate for reasons that are kind of hard to figure out.
And when an economy becomes depressed, how does it affect the play of the game?
Well, you know, it's one of these things. It's kind of like the hyperinflations in Germany in the 20s. A savvy, what was Don, a tailor or a savvy armor crafter has got to keep his or her eye on the value of the currency within the game, like how many, you know, what are the standard holdings of money of various people, and adjust their prices accordingly. You got to keep raising your prices with the rate of inflation, or you're not getting your bang for your labor that you've put into something. So you basically people who thrive in the economies of these games have got to be very active economically, very brilliant strategically, just like people on Wall Street.
Yeah, I was going to say if they could do it in Camelot, presumably they could do it on Wall Street.
Well, you know, that's sort of an open question. We in the game research area, we're always wondering, what are the real-world implications of skills you pick up in games? Now, I don't know if I play Grand Theft Auto 3, you know, which is about shooting people on the street, what I'm really learning. But in these worlds, you know, these are social skills. It's understanding markets. It's understanding politics. It's running large organizations with very diverse sets of people with their emotions. I got to think that what was her name? Laura is going to come out of this presidential election with a hell of a lot more savvy than, you know, your typical eighth grader. I think it's a fantastic learning tool from that standpoint.
So there's real value in studying these online worlds and their economic and political systems.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, my vision of a future in this area is that we could set up parallel worlds that are same in you know, most senses, but then, you know, vary some things. Like, oh, let's have a dictatorship here and a democracy over here and see if people can topple that dictatorship and see if they can do it peacefully. Or how can we as outsiders induce that kind of peaceful revolution? You know, these are sort of social science laboratory questions that humanity has never been able to answer before. Now we have a tool that can do that.
On the other side of this equation, when you have Weimar-like inflation, do dictators tend to rise in some of these places?
Well, the standard model for political control is actually not elections and presidents. It's something more mafiosa-like, where there are strong people who run family-like organizations, and you get by in that society politically by having good friends,
so
having friends in high places.
Yeah, it's who you know, not what you know.
Absolutely. And you know what? This creates some of the problems of social control that people are talking about in a game like Sims Online, because there is social deviance. You know, you get a society, you're going to have social deviance. And then suddenly you have governance issues and policy issues. And I think we've learned that the strong family system isn't really the best way to handle that. These worlds are sort of moving towards a more democratic system, but it's not clear that they're ever going to get there. It's a very interesting question.
We're speaking with Ted Castronova, an economist at California State University at Fullerton, about metaverses online. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's hear from another caller. Dylan is on the line with us from Boulder, Colorado.
Hey, how's it going?
All right.
Thanks for having me. I play a game called Star Wars Galaxies, and it's basically, it's like the other games that have been discussed already, but it's set in the Star Wars world. Right around the time of the first three movies, and I'm a professional promoter. Actually, I have about a 10 to 15, it fluctuates, person corporation that helps me throw these enormous parties every 3 months.
Online parties?
Yeah. Yep.
And what are they like?
The first one really started as an experiment to see if people would actually come out to a party, but basically, it's evolved to a point where I actually have my own city that I built along with the people that I work with. That's used as the venue for the latest party I have. Basically, I bring a lot of people. Everyone who sells all the things that you can buy in the game. So I set up a huge mall.
Dylan, your phone line's breaking up, I'm afraid. Just one question. We're going to let you go. How much time do you spend doing all this?
You know, I can move to a different part of the house.
You can move to a different part of the house. Okay. Let's see if that'll work. We're speaking about these online universes, games that people spend real money on, not only to get the software and pay their fee every month, but sometimes to buy various kinds of powers and skills. Dylan, let's hear how you are now.
Can you hear me now, Neil?
A little bit better.
Okay. The latest party I had, basically people come to shop and they come to hang out with, basically around 1,000 other people come. We try to set up everything that you can do in the game all in one place.
Now, who's your avatar, your alter ego in this game?
His name is Keldrian Skycaster.
That's a great name. Did you make that up?
They have a thing on the website that actually lets you generate names, and I found them separately and put them together.
I see. So you're kind of a Luke Skywalker cousin.
Almost. My company is called Skycaster Omnimedia.
And you've been successful in online?
Yes, very. I mean, I started off as a poor crafter, and realized that I didn't really have the time to play in game to be, rich doing the conventional professions that people can do. So I kind of, made up my own. And, I'd say very successful.
Ted, that's exactly what you were talking about before.
Exactly. I mean, if somebody wants to hire a promoter, I can recommend Dylan because he's run 1,000-person parties several times. Great success. And he can point to a track record of the money in his account in the world sort of going up, and that's the market test. That guy sells.
It's really been an extension of my interest in promoting in real life. I've never gone anywhere near promoting, a real party of 1,000 people, but throughout my life I've thrown, different parties, weekend parties where, I'd have a couple hundred people come out. So it's really been kind of a really great tool for me to, really press it to a limit that isn't going to happen for me in real life.
Yeah. Well, what do you do in real life?
That's great. I'm a freelance graphic designer. So, I work probably 30 hours a week. So that leaves, I probably spend another 20 a week either playing or, managing different things that I have to do. So it's not crazy.
Okay. Dylan, good luck to you. And if you meet Luke, say hello.
I will.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break now. When we come back, we're going to continue exploring the economies of online worlds. We're going to speak with a writer who spent the past year scraping out a living selling ones and zeros for tens and twenties. Plus, we'll go to Houston, Texas, where a plea agreement with Lee Fasto, the wife of Enron finance chief Andrew Fasto, broke down today. An update on that situation. You can call us if you want to talk about the online world. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Today we're continuing our conversation about the economics of online gaming communities. Our guest is Edward Castronova, an economics professor at California State University Fullerton. We want to hear from you. Have you ever spent real money on a virtual item? Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And Ted, you've done some research into how much money a player can generate as a virtual currency trader. So what'd you find?
Well, as a virtual currency trader, I know of cases where people claim that they're earning six-figure incomes. And,
really?
And I wouldn't. I would not say this is the average outcome. Your results may vary.
Yes.
Right. But there are those who are savvy enough about how these markets work that they do things like there are sweatshops where you can recognize the fact that these gold pieces are selling at values that are pretty high given the amount of time it takes to get them relative to, let's say, wages in places like Hong Kong and Mexico.
So you would hire somebody in Hong Kong to play for you?
Yeah, you'd set up a little shop with a bunch of PCs and have low-wage labor sort of farm the world for gold pieces and magic wands, sell those on eBay, pay off the labor, and take the proceeds for yourself. There are people who claim that they're earning six-figure incomes doing that.
Here's an email we got from Kevin in San Francisco. A friend of mine at the University of Wisconsin, Stevens Point, wasted hundreds of hours on the game EverQuest. He neglected nearly everything, and when he was in danger of not paying his rent, eBay allowed him to sell some virtual items to make his rent. He pulled in well over $700, which was 2 months' rent, and we all decried him for wasting his life.
Yeah, I mean, again, as Henry Jenkins pointed out, the line between virtual and real is starting to blur here. If people, this is another story that a lot of college kids are paying for their books or their rent by selling off accounts and virtual items. And the fact is, value is being created there, and that creates earnings opportunities. And some people are better at it than others. College students have time and the computer skills to do well at this.
Well,
so,
let's
doesn't surprise me at all.
Let's speak with a virtual entrepreneur. Writer Julien DeBell is doing it publicly with a blog on his website. DeBell proclaims that on tax day next week, he will report to the IRS that his primary source of income is the sale of imaginary goods. And Julien DeBell joins us now by phone from Los Angeles. And welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you.
Why did you decide to try this?
Well, it was a mix of curiosity and compulsion. I had researched a story on this phenomenon, largely inspired by Dr. Castronova's work, and by, you know, looking into these games, I ended up getting addicted to one of them, Ultima Online, and found myself compulsively playing it. And at a certain point, said, you know, I've either got to cut this out or make it productive somehow. And I chose the coward's way out. And I had been inspired too by talking to some of these people that Ted talked to, had mentioned, that are making six figures. And I've talked to one that claims to be credibly to be making seven figures. And I thought, well, you know, I can do that.
Yeah, we've all had those sorts of thoughts. So how's it actually going?
It's a lot harder than it looks, and there is something to what Ted was saying, that, you know, there's a certain kind of skill and a certain kind of passion that may be more of a younger man or woman's game than someone of my age.
Burning out already, are you?
Yeah. Well, you know, it was a matter of, really, I think if I had pulled up stakes, you know, let go of all my writing commitments and you know, abandoned my family, I think I could have met my challenge. As it is, I'm finally in the last, you know, moments before April 15th, which is the deadline I'd set for myself for making more than I ever made as a writer doing this. I'm making a pretty hard go of it and may beat my best monthly income as a writer.
Well, since the IRS, we know, is not listening, how much money are we talking about?
I'm hoping to make profits of $4,600 in a month, and that would top my best year writing.
How much time does that cost you every day?
I'm spending about 8 to 10 hours a day, but I can't leave the computer ever because there's always customers, and I don't dare miss one.
Well, on your website, I understand you have items for sale for as much as $600. First of all, what are those, and how much are people willing to spend on some things?
Well, for instance, the game Ultima Online, which I play, has one of the most transparent markets in these economies, so it's easy to track prices. And the real estate is really the top commodity in the game, and what has a castle in the game Ultima Online has gone for as much as $2,000. And the reasons for that are, you know, it's like, well, Roger said, buy land, they're not making any more, God's not making any more of it.
Well,
but in this case, there are gods, and they do occasionally make more land, and that depresses the real estate prices. So that they have gone down somewhat in the last few months.
Well, let's get another caller on the line. John is with us from New York City.
Hi.
Hi.
I used to play a game called Utopia, and it was basically a kingdom of 25 people who had to work together on an island with 50 other kingdoms in a world with 50 other islands. And you learned a lot about politics, having to work with 25 other people from all over the world. But you got so much camaraderie out of it that I've even had taken it to the real world and met some of these people, and still keep up relationships, even though I haven't played in about 4 years.
And you decided not to play, but it was just taking too much time?
Well, yeah. You get up in the morning to see what happened overnight, and since it's worldwide, while you're sleeping at 6 o'clock in the morning in New York City, somebody's been up for 5 or 6 hours plotting against your kingdom, and you want to find out what happened. So you're constantly checking and checking and checking.
Julian DeBell, that must sound familiar.
Yeah, it is. I of course, have customers all around the world. I deal with people in Russia, in China, and I can't, you know, I can't ever shut my eyes, really, without thinking, you know, who's trying to, who wants to buy some gold, and I'm not there to answer their call.
Ted Castronova, a question for you. As these games continue to develop, you suggested that in each individual game, the economies tend to go south after a little while. But as we look ahead, is more money, do you think, going to be exchanged for more virtual items?
That seems to be the trend, and especially if you think about this technologically, you know, give humanity 2 or 3 generations, and then imagine for yourself all the processor cycles that are going to be available 40 or 50 years from now. What are people going to do with those cycles? Here we've got this technology that allows a small team of people to build a fantasy world. Think about the numbers of people who would rather just sort of live out their lives, let's say being a promoter like Dylan, than being a graphical design artist. You know, that could shift quite a lot of the economy into this virtual domain. And then collectively, these virtual economies, virtual societies, then become a very interesting, almost competitor to the real world.
Parallel universes. We thought they were just science fiction. Turns out they're just a click away. Ted Castronova, thank you very much.
Certainly. Thanks for having me, Neil.
Edward Castronova, professor of economics at California State University at Fullerton, joined us from the studios of KKJZ in Long Beach, California. Also, our thanks to caller John. We appreciate your time today, of course.
Thank you.
And finally, to Julian DeBell, a writer and online trafficker. We reached him by phone from Los Angeles. Appreciate your joining us today.
Thank you.
If you'd like to follow Julian's journey into the world of virtual sales on his website, you can find a link to it at our website, which, of course, is npr.org. Virtual worlds, what's going to be coming next? You're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News.